bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, everybody.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
So I want to start this off with sort of a thought that was started by one of our team members here who had a crazy weird dream.
Yes. You want me to tell the dream? All right. So here's the deal. I had this very vivid dream. And on its face, it was a dream that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. I was in my senior year of college and I had not gone to any of my classes. And I was now wondering whether or not I was going to graduate. But one of my professors,
notice he has not called it a nightmare yet. He's only referred to this as a dream. And many of us have lived this dream.
Well, yeah. I hadn't even thought of that because in the past it would have been a nightmare, but I think I've had this dream so many times. Now I kind of enjoy it. It's like familiar. But yeah, so despite the fact that I've graduated from college over a decade and a half ago, I still have these dreams. But the kindly history professor who was helping me figure out the path that I was going to be able to graduate was none other than former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter, in this world, was still an ex-president and was so famous and popular that he had a currently running Saturday morning kid show, animated kid show, wherein his wacky cast of characters were all sentient Southern food dishes, and the most popular of which was Po' Boy. Po' Boy was the star of the show.
Now, sorry. I actually don't know what goes into a Po' Boy. That sounds like a meat thing, right?
It's a sandwich. It's a New Orleans sandwich. So I'm sure Bryce can look up pictures
like
of
like shrimp.
Yeah. Seafood and whatnot.
Yeah, like a seafood sub in two words.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm with you.
But so Po' Boy was the star of the show. And I woke up this morning. And like you often have with these dreams, you have to realize certain things in order where it's like, oh, I graduated from college so many years ago. I don't have to worry about these credits that I've been worrying about in Dream World. Oh, I didn't have a college professor, Jimmy Carter, and the most disappointing was that the Jimmy Carter Saturday morning animated cartoon show also didn't exist, which is why I had to tweet about it this morning so I didn't lose it. Because the idea of Jimmy Carter's Saturday morning animated cartoon show with the wacky Po' Boy character was something that I mean, felt the world needed to know.
I assume number four is, man, I could really go for a Po' Boy right now.
Oh, baby, could I?
There is something about the idea of the danger of like recording our dreams and then playing them back is probably realizing like a high, they just don't make any sense unless you're high.
Yeah.
You know, cause that's part of like some drugs. They make you hallucinate connections between stuff like, it meant something. Like, maybe not. Maybe that's what the drug does is it makes you attribute meaning to things that don't have meanings. That being said, though, there are dreams that are super vivid and super real.
Yeah, like the dream of the perfect Po' Boy. Justin, tell the truth. Did you have a Po' Boy today?
I have not had a Po' Boy. I wouldn't even know where to get a good Po' Boy out here. You know, I guess like Popeyes is pretty much the only fast food place that does it. Otherwise, yeah, I don't know if I would trust a Po' Boy not in the South, not south of the Mason-Dixon.
I definitely woke up in the middle of the night, definitely hungry, definitely looked at the menu, definitely picked clam chowder, decided clam chowder, not interesting enough. Definitely poured soy sauce and clam chowder.
Clam chowder.
Regretted it.
From a can?
Yeah.
Those don't go together.
No, also, you
also,
love
what
soy
about
sauce.
This story coming from me?
How much?
Sounds
all right,
unreal. Like, right. I mean, that's
of the dishes you eat in a week. Give me the percentage that involves you adding soy sauce.
I would say one in four. One in four. Yeah.
Because I feel like that is something.
Things I will put soy sauce into. Pizza, just on pizza. It's great.
On pizza or as like a in a little ramekin and dipping.
No. Just and then throw that in there. And then beef ravioli recently.
Sure.
I've discovered is soy enhanced. Turns out clam chowder was not one of my best experiences.
Too creamy.
Not
too creamy. Mm-mm.
Nope.
Which is funny is that you've done all that without like getting to ramen or like things that traditionally people would like put soy sauce in. These are my point is that you are adventurous
ramen
with soy sauce.
Actually goes down with soy sauce.
What?
No.
You and you have like the cup noodle MSG too, right?
You throw extra MSG or maybe some ponzu sauce or something, but not soy.
Wow.
Soy has a loud voice. In fact, if you want to get interesting. What you do with your ramen is you put whoosh in there, a little Worcestershire sauce.
Oh,
yeah.
Can I show you? I just sent Bryce. There was a photo that somebody said this tweet like, "Oh, you think America's the greatest country? Check this out." And I'm already getting angry to be like, "How dare you tell me I don't live in the greatest country?" And then I saw this photo, and then I'm like, "Oh," and it was from Popeyes in South Korea.
Oh, I'm already
and
excited.
Bryce, you got the photo?
I don't think this is the photo you meant to send, but I insist to be shown.
No, I sent him two emails. The two emails there.
You sent me two. Okay, well, this is the right. Well, I got this one. Which
no, show that later. Later.
I see.
Check this out. I saw this and I'm like, you won. I'm questioning the 7 different chicken sandwiches they have at Popeyes in South Korea.
Oh my god. Hot pepper roast, garlic burger, Cajun extreme,
sweet thigh burger,
Cajun tongue burger,
cheese bacon chicken burger, and chicken filet burger. Wow.
I will say this. When I was in Singapore, McDonald's had a spicy chicken sandwich that I have not been able to stop thinking about. Like they have like an exclusive thing in the Asian market, I guess, that was awesome. It was the closest thing that I've had, Brian, the Wendy's spicy chicken sandwich.
Yep.
The closest thing I've had from McDonald's to that was in the Asian market, where they actually mixed the breading was spicy and it wasn't like any kind of sauce on top.
Yeah.
Where are you at on the Chick-fil-A spicy? Because I think I'm backing away from it.
Eh.
I think it's too. Tight. I think it's too spicy. I don't like the. It's a pain in the butt.
It's not Wendy's.
I love going to McDonald's in other countries because, like, with Singapore, I had the Ninja Burger.
Oh.
You know, which is at McDonald's. They had a Ninja Burger with like the egg and everything else on top. It was crazy. India, the Big Mac Tikka Masala. It's like a Tikka Masala Big Mac, and it's amazing. Ooh. They have their peri peri fries. So, like, I love because people are like, oh, you go to McDonald's other countries, you're so unsophisticated. I'm like, no, like, they make their own menu there. And it's amazing to see, you know, what passes elsewhere because it's this global brand, but, you know, McDonald's somewhere else, it's like some of the staples are like very different. So, yeah, Justin, we think we've got video of your dream. Bryce found a live video tap into this. And I don't know if we're able to tap into this, but that is the idea. I love the idea of being able to basically capture dreams.
Yes.
There's a reason our brain scrubs dreams because we do a lot of weird things in our dreams. We run simulations. We practice things that we're working on sometimes in real time. Sometimes we mash up weird imagery to give us spontaneous new ideas. But there's one thing that we absolutely do, or two things. One is our bodies freeze themselves because they know that no good will come of being able to move while we're having these dreams. And then the second thing we do is the moment we wake up, our brains, as fast as possible, tries to erase the whiteboard of everything that just happened overnight. And I have to feel like that happens for a reason.
Yeah, I think that certainly, I mean, the idea that the part of our brain that forms longer term memories, you know, we don't do that. But I'm going to throw out kind of a crazy sort of theory here. What if being asleep is our natural state and being awake is just a thing we get do to get food and safety so we can be asleep? What if this is not the norm?
But also being awake is where we gather all of the pieces to construct the Minecraft of our wonderful dreamscapes. Shoot, I think you're convincing me.
Yeah, because we're just gathering nutrients so we can have a better moment of building our own little world. But then then what does that say? Like, so our friend Brett the Amtrak Aroundsville is, despite being a fairly upbeat guy, is also somebody who suffers from the most terrifying nightmares that I have ever heard in my entire life. That dude has horrifying dreams. So what does that say? Does Brett literally just lives to torture himself?
Oh.
If you know Brett, that's a fair answer.
All right, I believe we've tapped into the dream matrix yet again.
I'm back here with my girl.
The ex-president. Struck by a hurricane-powered dose of radiation while appearing at a celebrity golf tournament, our four former presidents are charged with powers and strength, rendering them all the more extraordinary. George Bush.
Read my lips. You're toast.
Ronald Reagan.
Just say no to pissing me off.
Jimmy Carter.
I have lost it in my heart to kick your ass.
Gerald Ford.
Hey.
Kidding their arsenal of phenomenal powers against Earthling and interplanetary foes alike. The fabulous foursome for right against might.
Was it something like that, Juice?
All right. Yeah. So, number one, this is going to be so far flung from like the weird things topic, but it just makes me so sad that political comedy is just in this like very reductive state. Because, like, the idea that it's like, all right, Gerald Ford, nobody knows how to make a joke, so you just have him go, hey, right? Or Chevy Chase realizing he's kind of boring, so now we're going to make him clumsy, despite the fact that he was an athlete. It's just funny. I don't know. It's so everything's so serious.
I mean, it's look, used to be that politics was grape juice. Now it's wine. You got to wait a bit, and then it'll be good.
Well, I'll keep waiting.
See, they should have lip-synced to Jimmy Carter giving a speech, and then it
would have exactly. And then it would have been like, oh, that's great. Remember when he said a thing? Now he's saying the thing again, but it's James Corden doing it. Now that's what I call political comedy.
But it is, we have an interesting idea, though, is we're being able to map the brain more and to look at sort of what's going on and even see like when parts of the visual part of it getting tapped into. The concept of recording a dream or our thoughts isn't as far out as it used to be.
Yeah, especially if, in fact, I would say not only a dream, but like once we crack it on a dream, I mean, why not a waking memory? Why not you have on a helmet and you're watching this Coachella concert and then later you put on that helmet and you get to relive that moment, you know?
Yeah, that's a thing I think about is the idea of like, if you had the ability to kind of go back to any sort of moment, would that be really cool? Yeah, that sort of points out Natalie Wood's Brainstorm. That was the film where the plot device was they built this sort of like dream recorder and there's a scientist working in this and she realizes she's having a heart attack. So she plugs herself into the machine to record the experience of dying in the afterlife.
That's interesting. So you realize, like, take your favorite podcast, right? And realize
this one.
Yeah. Like, there's four different recordings, and you can experience it from four different or five different perspectives. You can listen to it and be, you know, the customer, the audience. But it's like, how different would it be to feel every annoyance and thinking of tagging things as you adjust volumes as Bryce, or
the impatience of Brian, who is constantly interrupting or whatever, you know, or
those are horrible things. Why would any person want to live with that?
I kind of love this idea.
I mean, why would anybody want to live with that experience?
I mean, it seems to me like the closest thing you could get would be to go to patreon.com/weirdthings, where at the very least you'd be able to keep this show alive. Just $1 an episode. That's all we ask. You guys can keep us loud, live, and independent every Monday morning. you could join the hundreds of other people who are doing the exact same thing.
Oh, hell yeah, Brian. Head on over there, patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah, but it is an interesting thing because, you know, Brian, you brought this up too a lot, like how we have a recollection of what happened and why we did a thing, and often it's a lie we told ourselves. And so being able to experience a memory in the moment, even if our own memories, we might be like, oh yeah, no, I was really worried about this at this time, you know, like, oh, you know, I had to go pee halfway through Avatar, you know, the first time I saw it, and I wasn't really focusing on the story, you know, and you're like, oh wow, this is different than I remember it.
That's an interesting question. Like even if you had that option to find out whether or not you were right or wrong, would you take it? Because we spend so much time investing in deciding we're right on certain things, or that stuff happened for a certain reason. I gotta believe that an awful lot of us wouldn't even want to peek into the abyss of the possibility that maybe we were just flat out wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. I think of myself as a person that lives with uncertainty and the idea that I'm going to be wrong, but then I'm probably the moment that illusion is shattered for me and like, no, you cling to this and you cling to this. And then I'm going to have to be like, wah, sad face. I'm a lie.
But on the flip side, it's like if you're stepped outside of yourself and you're just watching you react to a thing, it becomes easier. Like when you're watching a 6-year-old have a meltdown, you don't believe it's really because she hates this movie. You inherently understand, oh, sweetie, you're just tired, you know? And it's like, and I don't know, wouldn't that be a gift that we could give ourselves to know that part of the reason that we're saying something has nothing to do with us being right or wrong or whatever?
I think the issue is also just how socializing our understanding of it. And I think that, in all honesty, this is partly what therapy gives you, right? Like therapy gives you the opportunity to reflect on situations and say, oh, okay, well, that was because I did this and this was because I did that. And there's different ways that you can look at the patchwork of what, you know, the decisions in our lives are. But if you could do that on a more real-time basis, or you could look back and say, okay, well, how do I believe this happened? Now let's go back to the videotape and see where I'm right and I'm wrong. Then yeah, hopefully that would be almost a more powerful tool to get you in the same position.
Yeah, there's that, you know, the value of theory of mind, of understanding what goes on in other people's heads. It can make you a lot more compassionate, and there are different tools for doing that. Really good storytelling is certainly one way to do that. And I think that is so much of the problem that we're dealing with right now, is we become we're exposed to so many other viewpoints. You know, you pop open Twitter for 10 minutes and it's not like when you'd watch the news and three people would explain to you the way the world was going. And 10 minutes, you have 100 different people kind of telling you their own points of view, but we're all kind of pushed back into our own. But yeah, once you have that ability to sort of just, it's why I love really good autobiographies, like really, really good sort of deep dives. It's one thing to have somebody tell me, I'm going to explain to you how the world works. You know, another thing to go read, you know, go read Feynman or James Baldwin or somebody else and just read from their point of view on stuff. And you're like, oh man, now I see it from the way you saw it, you know, and so helpful, you know, being able to drop into an experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's crucial. It's crucial to see the world from others' perspective. And that's for as much crap as we, I think, rightfully give the internet. The internet has become, has to me proven out its worth on humanity, because we come in conflict with everybody's perspectives a lot more often than we would otherwise. You know, we are less bound by geography and even certain things like class and race, you know, that has their own separating elements to it in terms of the real way that we all interact with each other. The internet flattens that out a lot. And, you know, that's what for all the doomsaying that we can do about it. My point is always to be like, well, you know, maybe it's not all bad. Maybe this is just the awkward adolescence. Yeah. This is us growing into the idea that we have to do it. And also sometimes that is ugly, much in the same way that if we were to look back and witness ourselves in a moment that we're not proud of, or a moment that we are proud of and then become unproud. Like there is a lot of reflection that we all have to do.
And I think that, yeah, like I'm personally, like, the net good is incredible. I think that, yeah, we're dealing with this, people not learning, the exposure to other ideas is painful if you're not prepared to deal with that. And I wish sort of the gatekeepers and the people who are kind of the ones who are trying to tell us the moral lessons would be conscious of their own tribalism. And I think that's such a sort of thing, is that's the biggest sort of thing that's frustrating a lot of this sort of stuff, is that anytime you encounter another or an opposing point of view, is we tend to have this sort of tribalistic, well, look at this dummy over here, you know, or,
yeah.
And then it's like, great, you just alienated that person from understanding your point of view. And it's like, if somebody's a jerk to you in traffic and you flip them off, you were right to flip them off, but the fact that you flip them off retroactively, they feel justified for doing the wrong, even though sequentially it makes no sense that that happened as a reaction.
Well, and it gets a little bit double complicated when your job is to, you know, try to be funny or keep a conversation afloat or whatever. Like I look back over, you know, 12 years of things that Justin and I have said on various iterations of Night Attack. And I'm like, we can't have been right and awesome all of the time. Sometimes we just went for what felt funny and that probably hurt people along the way.
You know, in an alt universe somewhere, though, you were right all the time.
We need parallel to get worlds. Back. Get back. Get back to the world where Brian and Justin have never said anything they regret. It's just, we just go back. We just go back. We're like, yep, holds up. Holds up, holds up, holds up. Better now.
That's called holds up. That's called holds heaven. Up. And it only happens after we die.
There is, and it's I think one of the exciting things about the potential for virtual reality, and that was one of the things talked about early on, is to sort of show different experiences. You know, there was an award-winning VR experience called Driving While Black, you know, which, you know, kind of delves into sort of, you know, one kind of different of experience. And I think that is, I'm excited about, as we use these tools for games and storytelling, to start help making it easier for people outside of game designers to tell. I mean, game designers have a lot to contribute, but other people, artists, have the ability to use these to tell narratives. You know, I think is kind of a very exciting sort of thing. And we're seeing more of that now. And obviously there's a potential for abuse. You can use this to radicalize and stuff, you know, is like, the people of Oceanlandia keep bombing us. This is how evil they are. Watch this VR thing. And you'll realize, is you could get triumph of the will, or you can get extremely sympathetic sort of things that help you understand. But, you know, like anything, you know, the tool's up to us to use. So,
yeah.
So recording Justin's dreams and sharing them for everybody.
There we go.
I would definitely subscribe to that newsletter. like the VR headset, just like, all right, what you got today?
You know what's funny? What's funny is I don't really remember a lot of my dreams, but that one was very, very vivid to the point where I wanted to tweet about it. And now I feel like I still remember most of the beats. Like I remember there was a restaurant we kept going to, and I remember there was like other elements of this bizarre campus that was like, I'm sure, an amalgam of Syracuse and other places that I've been to. But like, it was, it's weird how much that one has stuck with me. And I wonder if it's because I put it out, I made the point to put it out on Twitter.
I think that's something we've talked about before, where it's like all of your memories, you don't remember the actual event. What you remember is your last description of the last time that you remembered the event. Right. And so, the difference is you made it past the bridge of consciousness, and by speaking or typing aloud, your fading memories, you created an anchor that became the anchor that you've gone back to all day long.
Yeah. I'll buy that.
So, gentlemen, what's your favorite planet?
Sorry, Blanet?
Who? What? Huh?
Janet?
Oh, Janet Blanet?
Kramit?
You're not up on the new lingo? Apparently, some scientists have theorized that planets could form around black holes, but because they're formed around the black hole in the accretion disk, it would be called a blanet.
I mean, number one, awesome name. I love a blanet. Who doesn't love a blanet?
Yeah. So Brian, apparently,
I love all blanets equally, and I'm happy that they're finally being acknowledged.
So apparently, they're looking from like how far away from the black hole this could form, and I guess there's different sizes. There were some mathematical models. And I guess they're saying that like 100 trillion kilometers from the black hole itself. So it'd be way the heck out there. Okay. I mean, we're like, that can't be right too. I'm looking at this number like, no, it can't be 100 trillion kilometers because I don't think that's, I got to pull this thing up because this is one of these things where I'm like, I think somebody missed a number there because that makes no sense to me. But anyhow, the idea though that of, imagine a planet forming around a black hole and the idea that like, hey, this is your life. This is what we think is normal. You know, this seems pretty cool. So there's apparently a safe zone that could handle like thousands of them around it.
So there's a safe space for planets.
Yes. So apparently, you know, at the center of our center of our Milky Way, we have a big black hole. There's a big black hole right in the middle of there, right? And there could be, they say there could be thousands of planets circling around there.
The next question is, I ask, is there intelligent life on planets? And then it just everything about this feels weird. I don't like any of this. We've talked about dark planets before where there's enough energy that they could form life due to the pressure, similar to the, you know, the, the chimneys at the bottom of the earth. But there's no getting out, is there, right? Like there's no sending a rocket out of a planet.
No, there could be. So you've got to figure out like if you have, let's say an earth sized planet, at the orbit that is orbiting a black hole, it's the escape velocity from that planet would be relative to whatever the mass of the planet is. Your escape velocity for that black hole system, it might not, I would have to know like the mass of like the, how, because these are supermassive black holes, but a certain distance you do have an escape velocity from there.
If it's in a stable orbit of the same mass, you could presume that on the planet you would have roughly the same gravity. And then once you escape that, if anything, you've got slingshot, a vector to really fling you out there.
Well, there's an escape velocity for our own solar system too, though, because of the mass of the sun. We have a solar escape velocity too. You can get out of the Earth orbit and go to Mars. Then to escape our solar system, you need a higher velocity to be able to do that. But it might be, somebody who's better could probably, but there would be. But the other thing too is that like one of the things we've discovered like right now is, you know, that whole, we've talked about the idea that there's a planet X or another planet in our solar system that's pulling at the Oort cloud and there's objects out there. So we've talked about before, I think that the idea that it might be a small black hole, which our galaxy spins and our solar system rotates around the galaxy. And since the Earth has been formed, since life has formed on Earth, there's been like four or five rotations of the galaxy, meaning Earth has gone all the way around the galaxy, passing all those things. So capture of other objects is another thing. So you could have a black hole with other objects there, and you could get a star or somebody else that has a trajectory that's not going to get captured by that. And that would be another option to sort of have escape.
Hold on. Okay, so you got an Earth-sized planet that is in a system that just by pure luck happens to have captured 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 star-like suns. So you have various degree and a few moons going around. So you have an equivalent of day and night or whatever. Okay, now you're getting me on board. This seems unlikely, but very cool.
Well, there's going to be, the more we look, there's going to be a lot of very exotic systems and stuff. And there are solar systems and stuff that have been captured by black holes and maybe be doing an orbit around them, but it'd be very slow. Like the orbit around your supermassive black hole might be a million years. You may spend a million years going around this thing.
Well, and I was thinking recently about how our perception of time itself is fundamentally different. I mean, I can't swat that goddamn fly because he sees time different than me. You know, it's like he sees a big, dumb, stupid ape arm coming down. He looks at his watch, decides whether or not to finish Seinfeld, and then flies off just before the squash happens. Like, once you break time and you say something can live for 3,000 years or whatever, how are we ever even going to know whether or not we've encountered other intelligent life?
Well, it's the key question. And we have ideas on how to look for life like ourselves, but, you know, we don't even know if Neanderthals had language like we did. And we don't know, you know, we went to South America, you know, when the conquistadors went through there, you know, in their polite little goodwill tour, you know, they saw...
They were just looking for golden hour. You know, that hour where they got all that gold.
Gold, yeah. And, you know, certainly in the collisions of the Aztecs and the Mayans, you could see these civilizations there. But as we went deeper into the jungles and explored deeper into there and see these hills, these mounds that for centuries were just considered dirt hills. And then at some point, somebody looking at, you know, satellite photos and stuff noticed there's a lot of regularity there. Yeah, there was a really intelligent group of people living there, building entire farm systems, you know, farm systems, had entire, you know, had their government, had, you know, city planning, had markets, had all these incredible things there that eventually the jungle took back. And those signs were hard for us to sort of recognize. You know, we have signs of hard time recognizing our own signs of intelligent life. You know, you watch primate interactions. I saw a video, David Attenborough video, and they show this orangutan in a canoe. And the orangutan's by itself in the canoe using its hand to paddle along. And then they show these other orangutans. One's got a hammer, playing with the hammer, banging nails into a board. Not always the right way. And another one is sawing a board, using its feet to hold on to the board and the other hand to work the saw. And you're like, if you were better at that, you would be amazing. Like, you know, the end of it for us.
Well, I feel like we might get too diffuse on this subject. So let me bring back. We did an episode of The Modern Rogue where we talked about one particular article where we talked about the concept of how do you cross the infinite abyss of deep time. We're getting ready to put a whole bunch of fissile material, a bunch of radioactive stuff all in one place. How do you make it clear long after language has atrophied, long after imagery has changed and so on, that nothing good waits for you here? Because you can't even, like, a skull and crossbones originally meant Christ's ascension, conquering of death, and it was meant as a celebration when captains would put it in their logs or whatever. And it's like, if that changes over a few thousand years, how do you cross the gulf and give a message of any kind of message over 100,000 years?
Brian Brushwood, pirate apologist.
Yes. put me down, man.
Bryce just pulled up the warning about nuclear radiation and stuff. How do you put warnings about that? And that's historically, you would see that, like, it's, you know, we talk about, somebody brought up the book 1491, which is this overview of, like, of America before, you know, the Europeans showed up to the party and what was going on there. And the more we dip into the Mesoamerica civilization,
back when everybody was getting along and everything was hunky-dory.
Well, you know, but it is curious because, like, you look at, like, the Algonquin, their trading empire and their market, like, you know, it was comparable to, like, the Europeans, some of the bigger European cities and stuff. And it wasn't what we had immediately recognized, but you look at what's going on there. And that was sort of the thing that's sort of fascinating. And there's a lot of wonderful YouTube videos and series that are out there, like, what if this didn't happen? What if somebody else, what if the Vikings decided to continue colonizing? What if the Aztecs, you know, decided to go further north, all this sort of stuff. And it is done by somebody who knows what the heck they're talking about. Those are really good, you know. But, yeah, as far as just, you know, talking about, like, you know, the state of things before and the state of things after and recognizing them. You know, how do you have these long-term warnings? Like, yeah, burial grounds and stuff like this. Like, don't go here. Well, that means there's something you have something cool there, right?
Right. Like, yeah. like the more ostentatious, the more obviously like, no, don't come here. You make it the more like seems pretty metal to me.
Like, yeah, is part of that just updating, like, or trying to make it as clear? Because you're right, no shout into the distance as clear as it could be now will ever really be truly heard in 10,000 years in the way that you want it to, right? So it's like the key then is once every 100 years somebody making that message clearer to the modern ears.
That was one of the proposals was to create an atomic priesthood, a group of people who were charged with only one mission, like long after nothing makes sense and you don't even know why you're saying it, you have one mission, and that's to say, don't go in there. Like, yeah. Make up whatever mythologies you need to, write down whatever sacred texts you need to, create whatever religions you need to. You have one mandate. Nobody goes in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody watched too much like Last Crusade.
yes.
I think we have no experience knowing how to make sure to engineer that so it doesn't do the opposite. And I like to just like dig it really deep. Just dig really deep. If you guys can do the work to get down here and to get to this stuff, then have at it. You know,
I guess, yeah.
You have the, you apparently have the technology to, you know, you're smart enough to dig this deep. You're smart enough to figure out why you shouldn't be digging this deep, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, put a lot of dead bodies in there.
Yeah, just have it like a secret, right? Like the idea that, okay, well then where do people dig if they don't know where to dig? Right. Like,
well,
like
that was like a big thing. Like you look at, you know, the Egyptians rest on this, like with the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens and the Valley of the Monkeys too, was a thing too, is that you hid the tombs. You know, we know where you're like, hey, look at this shiny pyramid out here that we put like metal foil over it. I mean, that's the thing too, is we, in the movies, we still see the pyramids with like the rough blocks when it actually had, you know, the smooth surfaces on it. And then like the capstone with the gold foil and stuff, like what the pyramid looked like back then, it's great. Everybody's looking at there. And like, meanwhile, Valley of Kings is where we're hiding our real secret stuff and then hiding the entrances and killing anybody that helped us build it.
That's a rough gig.
Ah, here's your safe room, Mr. Brushwood. Oh, yeah. Well, will I smell this thing? Will I tell you if it smells like chloroform? Why, yes, it.
Man,
all fun questions. So Blanets, look those up. I think those are kind of pretty cool. I'll do one more story. This is a tech story. There's a company called Hour One, and they just did a seed funding because they're going to generate AI driven synthetic characters from real humans.
I'm okay with that as long as the real humans are compensated appropriately, right? Like, do you mind if somebody makes a 80% of an Andrew Main, but you get, you know, $100,000?
Yeah, dude, I want you as my agent. Sure.
Yeah.
Would have settled for an Arby's gift certificate.
Bryce, what would your price be?
To just completely take my likeness?
Yeah. Or to have somebody, let's say it takes 2 weeks. They do a very thorough scan. They promise it won't ever truly be mistaken for you, but it's like 80% of you.
It wouldn't be a perfect likeness.
I mean, not if they squint and look like a fraternal twin. Imagine a fraternal twin, only totally digital.
Forever?
Yeah, they could do whatever they want with it. It would be long dead, and they will still have that likeness and could do whatever they want.
I don't have an exact number, but I think my ballpark would be $200,000 to $500,000.
Let me get my checkbook.
But that's a long time for someone to have not just your likeness, but like the building blocks of your likeness. I
your mannerisms, your default right. beliefs, your
my voice.
Well, yeah. think about
whether,
like,
or not you would tilt your head at a certain type of joke. You know,
when
again,
you use,
not exactly, but 80%.
When you use, like, Google Voices or, like, Amazon's Voices, you pay, like, per word. There's, like, a, like, you know, 1,000 words per, like, you know, I forget the fee is or whatever like that. And that will be a very interesting pricing model when you're like, oh, we want to have Morgan Freeman as our chatbot, you know? Yeah. And then every time you open up a website and have Morgan Freeman explain something to you, the idea that he's getting ching-ching-ching, that his cash register somewhere
or
is ringing up.
Or at least his estate is, you know, his great-great-grandchildren or so on. Yeah.
No, he'll still be around. We're going to preserve
yeah,
him.
Yeah, okay, fair
yeah,
enough.
He's not going nowhere.
Yeah. But... yeah, I think it's just it gets into a very interesting idea when you talk about, like, because we've dealt with this to an extent now with authors and having estates. We continue to write books set within their universe for that.
The dude who's, like, long dead, but he has a team that just keeps on publishing under his name?
Tom Clancy?
Is he dead?
Herman yes. Cain?
Herman Cain, yeah.
Herman Cain with his tweets now, yeah.
No, I'm thinking of neither of them. Some other one. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, but yeah, that's a thing that happens, you know, and think about, you know, because also you think about, like, Disney as a company, you know, we still think of, like, the a lot of the touches of Walt Disney, and it's evolved and changed considerably since then. But, you know, that aspect of that too, or you think of, like, you know, Apple and the legacy of Steve Jobs. And, you know, of course, that was his advice, like his parting advice to Tim Cook was, like, don't ask yourself what I would do.
Yeah.
Do what you think is right. And I think that was, like, a great kind of thing. Like, don't try to just continue to make the company thinking what I would want, make it what you want it. But because he knew that power of myth, that power of, like, oh, well, we got to do what our founder said. And it's like, you know, like Walt Disney's grave, like, yeah, Walt Disney was born, like, in another century, you know, like, and, you know, over time, we want to have different things. Yeah. If somebody brought up, like, yeah, Frank Herbert. Yeah. Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, you know, yep. They still write the Dune books. So, it's like they've never seen Looker. You're talking to the world's number one Michael Crichton fan here. So back up. Looker was another one of Michael Crichton's extremely prescient sort of stories. And
they scan the naked lady and she jokes, help, rape, or whatever.
Well, yeah, the idea was that they were basically digitizing all these, like, top models, that, like, killing off the models so they didn't have to pay them. It was a very silly premise to be like, yeah, no, how about if we just $20,000, we're good? Oh, okay, cool. It was a very kind of like, and then they have to kill them off. Like, he had this great idea, this great sort of premise he wanted to talk about, the idea of digitizing characters and doing this. This was a book, like, Looker came out, like, 1980. I mean, it's just something, like, crazy early, but, you know, first mention you'll hear of a computer bug, like, is in the movie Westworld that he wrote and directed, talking about, like, you know, this thing keeps replicating and we don't know. And the idea of these things are, like, the offhand thing is thrown out there about, like, they don't know how the robots worked because they were designed by robots, which, you know, second order AI. So,
like, that'll ever happen.
Yeah, I know. But Michael Crichton, I'm like, man. Still a fan. That guy that we've never had an author that got things like he did.
Agreed.
Legend.
Yep. All right, gentlemen, picks.
I got an old pick for you guys. So for a heretofore unannounced and undisclosed project, I've been spending a lot of time in 1964. And part of that is understanding the landscape of entertainment. And so I wound up getting sucked into a couple of YouTube episodes, although I'm sure, I don't know if they're on Disney Plus, of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. This was a show that aired. It was basically a part of really from 1954 into, you know, the present day, the idea of the Wonderful World of Disney or Walt Disney's Disneyland. But, this is hosted by Walt Disney. And if you know, for me, and hell, I'm in my late 30s at this point, Disney was primarily defined by the theme parks and the animated movies and then Disney Channel. But if you really want to get a greater sense of how the brand of Disney was built and how much Walt Disney specifically was a part of that cult of personality that then kind of becomes this much larger thing, then I think it's really instructive and it's really fun. The production is just awesome. The episode that I got caught up into was all about dinosaurs, and it just begins with a Walt Disney walking through this animatronic dinosaur set, and he's interacting with them like they're real dinosaurs. Just super fun and one of those elements of nostalgia that I think really holds up.
He was such a futurist, and he used that platform, one, obviously, to promote Disneyland. It was part of the financing deal between ABC and Disney, but also because he was very much, you know, he made, when World War II was coming around, he read an article in Collier's where one of the proponents of air power was saying that air power could be the deciding factor for the next war. Walt Disney had a cartoon commissioned and all that to talk about air power and why we need to build an air force. And then in the wonderful world of Walt Disney in the 1950s, he had like Wernher von Braun on there to explain, like talk about going to the moon, how we would go to the moon and then how to go to Mars, and looking up the space episodes. They're fantastic because he brought in real scientists. All of them had German accents, by the way. we're just out of World War II, and now America's living room is welcoming these wonderful German scientists out, and some of them happen to actually be Nazis. That's fine. It's not here nor there. But it was very, really the power of Disney to explain stuff. And remember, like, they made a lot of their regular income was from doing educational films, these animal films, these documentaries and stuff. And so the power of education there was incredible.
And yeah, I love watching those. It made me like think like, oh wow, I wonder who could do this now, because there is an element of like gravitas, but also the fact that he was somebody that was a builder, somebody that wanted to bring the fantastic to life.
You didn't like the Michael Eisner era one when he did them?
Bit of a quality drop. You know, the difference in personalities between CEOs and Walt Disney, they would have been better off finding someone to play the role. But then again, it's like, that's kind of the magic. That's the magic of a Walt Disney. It's the magic of a Steve Jobs or something like that. And you can pick at it, but at the end of the day, they're the guys that are really driving the bus, and there is this weird charisma to them that you want to follow. And obviously Disney was more of a showman.
There are a few names you could float, from Neil deGrasse Tyson to Adam Savage to Vsauce to but all of them. We live in an age where all narratives are more complicated now, and now for every person that sounds like a good idea, there's somebody else saying like, yeah, well,
those are also kind of communicators and not necessarily people who've made a thing talk about the thing they made. I mean, like, they all like Savage made things, but you know what I love is the SpaceX podcast now, or the SpaceX live streams, because the people you watch them, and you could easily confuse the people talking for hosts they hired. They're all high level engineers.
Except for one person. There's one voice that pops out and you recognize him every freaking time, and he's my favorite voice.
Oh, not normal.
I don't even know his name.
I think you're talking John Innsbruck. Yeah, but like, yes. He's wonderful. But people love him because he's a real kind of guy. But the younger people you first watch are like, oh, these photogenic TV. Like, no, they're all engineers.
And yeah, they all work there. Them,
and it's, I love that. I love the fact that SpaceX has a large enough workforce. They have the people, the ability to explain stuff, because then they'll like, oh, the RTC 101, what? And you're going like, these people are legit, because I don't know what that means, versus somebody, you know, some dumb science explainer trying to pretend they're Carl Sagan.
I wonder if there is a world where either SpaceX or Blue Origin or something like that, where they would just do something like, you know, Wonderful World of Color or Walt Disney Presents, where it's like, let's just explain what we're doing and what our goals are and what the stuff is in kind of a highly polished documentary series kind of way. I think people would eat that up.
I think I think we're going to see more of that from SpaceX as they start communicating about what they're doing. You know, and Elon Musk is part of his charm is he's so off the cuff. You're like, you know, he didn't spend the last 5 days like Steve Jobs obsessing over every semicolon in his speech. Yeah. But as these presentations have got better, and then when they go off the rails, it's hilarious, like the Cybertruck window.
Yeah, he's smashing the window. I mean, that's because Elon would probably be the name that you would come up with to say, like, all right, the guy that does the thing that also obviously wants to be in front of the camera. But boy, the difference between a Steve Jobs and a Walt Disney in terms of being a presentational showman and Elon Musk's is quite a gulf.
So there is that story about when Elon Musk was on Big Bang Theory, because he got him to go do a cameo, and they have the set set up, you know, they told him where he's going to stand and all that. And Elon says, one second. Does anybody here have time to teach me real quick how to act? and one of them is like, all right, hold on. And then takes him aside, whatever, and explain it to him. Because Elon's like, I've never acted before. What am I supposed to do? And, you know.
I'm going to give you three moves. You're going to tap your lips. You're going to furrow your brow. You're going to nod twice. And then look over your shoulder. That's acting. Congrats.
Well, that's like, you know, like with the case of Walt Disney, remember, he was as a kid, he was a performer. You know, he used to go perform, do stuff. He did the voice of Mickey. So he had that showman background. You know, Steve Jobs, like, you know, my favorite story, I've mentioned this before, of like Steve Jobs is, you know, the head of Hewlett Packard sitting at his desk one day, and he gets this teenage kid, like this 12-year-old kid is on the other line going, I can't afford some parts. Do you have any extra parts you can send me for my project? You know, it's like, who are you? It's like, oh, my name's Steve Jobs. I'm working on a project for class. Like, all right, because young Steve Jobs just called up the head of HP and asked, and the guy gave it to him. He's like, do you want an internship? You know, and no, I'm going to do my own thing. Click.
Yeah, screw that, you. you know, it's a fascinating. Just that idea, which I feel like is kind of retro cool now. As everybody is kind of creating their own content. Back then, it's like, it took all these machinations of having the agreement with ABC to do it, and then NBC. And now it's like, oh no, now everybody's in the tell your own story business.
Yep. Other picks?
I got a pick. Surprise pick. I didn't see it last week, even though it was our assignment. But I did watch the alternate take, which I didn't care for. But I watched two episodes of Star Trek Lower Decks. I liked it a lot. And I think I liked it because it spoke a language that was unrepentant. Like, either you got everything or you got none of it. Either way, it kept on moving. And I've had a lot of fun.
I watched Star Trek Lower Decks too, Brian, and I have a take on this too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I liked it too.
Yeah.
I liked it. I was
afraid there was going to be a fight.
Yeah. Well, Brian, let me tell you why your opinion on this cartoon is why you are. My girlfriend who's never watched any Star Trek did not get as much out of it, maybe both, shocker. I liked it because, like, the pacing was really good. I didn't realize they were going to go for Rick and Morty level jokes, but they clearly said they start out from the beginning, like, you know, crew members getting drunk, you know, physically mauling each other, sex jokes, all kinds of other stuff. And I liked the humor. I liked the pacing. There's a little bit of kind of the type of character that's the uber person that can never do no wrong kind of stuff. But it's set, like, they've set up some character flaws there and whatever.
It's body humor in the vein of Rick and Morty, but unlike Rick and Morty, where you just have to assume everything that they say is a thing. It's a little bit more fun, I find, to hear them say a nonsense thing and to constantly be thinking, I know what that is. I know what that's talking about. I know that character.
I know what that is.
Yeah, right? I mean, so it probably gets an unfair boost from familiarity, but I've enjoyed it quite a bit.
I mentioned about Spoiler in Time last week when we talked about it, because I've been watching it for a long time too. As someone who doesn't have like a lot of Star Trek knowledge, I can tell when they're like making those references and I don't, you know, get them. And so, I can tell like, good for the show in that it doesn't, you don't need to have that, right? You can just like, okay, that's another race of aliens, or that's some guy from the shows or something. But it does feel, I don't know, it's on CBS, so what else can you expect? But it does feel very like normy to me. Like, yeah, there's violence, there's drinking, there's bar brawls, whatever.
It's Go Teen Titans 5 years later. But imagine you've read all of the DC universe and it gets an upgrade for all of the references they're making.
I was surprised by it. I'm curious to continue watching other episodes of it. So like, yeah, I noticed like you see there is this collision now. You see like with Picard, which I enjoyed Picard. Like I enjoyed Picard. A lot of hardcores don't like it. Not because their problems with the story structure or the characters. Their problem is like, I like this for this thing, and you did a different thing within the thing I wanted, and the Federation's pure. How dare you? Because it's boring if you really pay attention. The Federation is this horrific fascist Marxist enterprise, and it's time to take it down
socialist.
A notch. Even beyond. Nobody has any property, Brian. Nobody owns anything.
Hey,
I want to go to the planet.
They're still using money in the 21st century?
Money. And then like, how do you pay your taxes on this vineyard here, Picard? How does this work?
Why do you need a military fleet if you have a non-interventionist policy?
I don't understand. Sure, a lot of white humans running the show for this star fleet.
We're gonna start attracting letters. We have to stop talking now. suffice to say, I like Lower Decks. It sounds like you like Lower Decks as well.
Yes. Yeah. And another thing.
I've got a pick. I spent most of yesterday binging an older, I don't know what it's called, six years old now, I guess. A supernatural drama. You might know it as The Leftovers from HBO. It holds up, like still holds up, does a really good job at presenting a mystery. And this is my second time going through it. I did watch it week over week for spoiler time all those years ago.
I was wondering how much knowing where stuff was headed would take away from it, but it sounds like it holds up.
It holds up, and what's kind of nice is that there are some payoffs to the mysteries that are going on in the story, but equally they're not like very, like they don't like deconstruct here's what happened and here's why. It's you get closure rather than answers. And for a show that's this length, right, it's 28 episodes instead of however many seasons of Lost there were.
I think 100. Yeah. I think they tried to hit that syndication 100. Yeah.
Right. And so it has a very compact mystery. There's not a lot of time wasted or stretched out. And I think they do a good job of, especially in the first season, because it's based off a book, and the first season pretty much covers the book, and then seasons 2 and 3 are original, of setting up new mysteries and new weird, interesting things that are going on in the world, and relating that to, well, how do you handle grief? How do you handle grief on a mass scale when, you know, the planet would never experience this much grief other than having this event happen?
There's definitely a long meditation on, like, who do you believe in a world where everybody has witnessed the unbelievable?
Right.
You know? How do you tell a charlatan in that world?
Right. There's a lot of really interesting things there in The Leftovers. So that's strong rec.
I'll check it out, because I've been hearing that, despite, because I never got into it because I knew the novel didn't have a resolution to it. And I'm one of these people, when you tell me this amazing premise, and if like, I want to watch people either die trying to figure out what it is, or we figure out what it is, you know, like I don't mind open-ended mysteries as long as people realize this is a thing that changes everything about us. Yeah. But I'll check it out.
There's a payoff. There's a payoff to it.
Coming out, like you could decide whether or not you think they're right or wrong, but there's definitely an answer that is handed to you by the end.
Yeah.
And right, cool. And we'll I was satisfied with the answer. I was comfortable with it.
Yeah. And okay, and cool. Only 28 episodes.
All right, no more.
Okay.
You sold me.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
The Leftovers on HBO Max also.
Since Brian stole my pick, that was actually my pick, ooh, Brian. Thank you very much. I'll pick another thing, which was I checked this out on Apple TV, which is Ted Lasso.
You was that good? I mean, I guess you're picking it.
So it is a very, you know, kind of a low key sort of story. Is Jason Sudeikis? How do you say his name?
Sudeikis.
Yeah, Jason Sudeikis. You know, who's always great. He, you know, he plays a American football coach who gets hired to come coach a British football team. Obviously, you know, soccer, as we say here. And it's a very sort of interesting premise. He's just kind of this, the accent kind of gets to me a little bit, but he's this very, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of guy, but supposed to be a really good coach, you know, and sort of this, you know, kind of a neat premise of a guy all of a sudden, you know, being put into an entirely different environment there. I enjoyed it. He's likable. Everybody's likable. It's a neat little sort of spin on, hey, let's take a look at this culture, what's different about it, et cetera. So they put three episodes out there, and we just watched all three in a row because we're like, oh, we enjoyed this, you know.
So. Nice. I saw, I guess, a trailer for it or something. I think it's a really cute concept, so I'm glad to hear that it, like, pays off or that
well,
it's
only
good.
Well, three episodes in. We'll yeah. see. You know, their Apple yeah. TV's doing their watch the first three, then see where, like, I never finished For All Mankind because, like, they did the first three, and then I got into a couple more, and then I'm like, is this all going to be like Guns on the Moon? I'm like, is this what this show is going to be? It's like, you know, space guns, or I'm like, ah.
I was actually just thinking about starting For All Mankind because it, yeah, you know, the upgrade that everything gets when it's bingeable.
Well, yeah, it's funny. Whenever there's those things, I just always remember this Saturday Night Live sketch where they would have other people that auditioned for Pulp Fiction, and it was Burt Reynolds in the Samuel L. Jackson role, and he's doing the Royale with Cheese monologue, Norm Macdonald doing Burt Reynolds, and then he's like, cut. This whole movie gonna be about burgers, Quentin? and that's whenever there's a thing where it's like, oh, is this whole thing, it's gonna be about Guns on the Moon, I just think, like, so picture gonna be about burgers, Quentin?
yeah so I was kind of like ah, oh, like, all right, like, there's cool all right. You know, Burt Reynolds was gonna be in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah he was on The Ranch, right?
He was
Yeah, and then man. And then I think also there was somebody else that played him, like played Burt Reynolds, like in that time period. That there still are rumors that they're gonna break that out. An extended Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, they're gonna do a 4-part Netflix version. That
Brian is
has
really looking forward to the 1-hour take of Brad Pitt driving through old Los Angeles.
I'll tell you what, man. Look, once you get the joke, you take as long as you want on that joke, because I know the punchline's coming, and I'm okay with all of it.
I loved that movie so much. So much loved it.
I agree.
I hated that movie.
I loved 20% of
that movie. Fan fiction. It's boring fan fiction.
I mean, you're really not wrong in that it is fan fiction, and it's telling a very specific story that if you're not invested in it, then I don't know exactly how much you're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
The more I've read and I listen to, again, the great Must Remember This series that goes way in depth on a lot of the background, and also like where film was and where music and culture was in the 60s leading up to that. And the idea that, like, there's a lot of parallels of, like, this was the dream of the 60s had soured. And this was like the example of how exactly people realized, oh no, wait, we had a revolution, and really all it did was bring the most disgusting elements of society to the fore.
You know, and a great follow-up to that was Jonestown. You know, Jim Jones was at the center of the movement out there in California, San Francisco. all you had people like, you know, Willie Brown, Jim Jones, this is great guy, Jay, you know, and you know, Jerry Brown, the governor, and all, a lot of Hollywood people love Jim Jones. This guy, what is, because his ministry was this very, you know, reached out to all people and whatnot. And, you know, that's another example of like how he was sort of the epitome of that. And he's like, you know, we'll just go create, we're going to create our own little place down there in Guyana. You know, we're just going to create our own little, we can all, people's temple can all get together here. And then it falls apart and then 900 people die. And, but hey, you know.
But they saved that woman. So in the movie.
Oh no, in the movie. Yeah.
In the movie. So cool. Great. On that note, cult suicide ending. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.